got one more barrel to blast here in our shotgun here this morning, and that's the young guy with the most energy, and we saved him for last here, he gave an excellent presentation last year, Sean Finnegan, his wife Ruth, are living up in New York near Albany, and he's a graduate engineer and also a graduate of Anthony Buzzard's associated school there, Atlanta Bible College, and is now going out to, in some way, ask God to use him to develop a ministry, and he's kind of fluid and open on that right now, how that might develop as time goes on, but he's got a real heart for God, and he's really wrapped his mind around this subject. And I'm looking forward to what he's going to be giving us today, which is very practical. Should Jesus be worshipped? A practical conundrum facing those who believe only the Father is God. Sean Finnegan.
Everybody want to stand up for a minute and stretch your legs a little bit? Or?
This way I can investigate.
That's right. And so anyhow, my topic for today is, should Jesus be worshipped? A little bit about me. I come from a background from the Way International. I was just a little kid when my parents got kicked out of it. There was a power struggle when the main leader died, and the person who was in charge of it requested loyalty to him over anything else. And my father and many others couldn't give that sort of loyalty. And so many of the pastors were fired when I was just a child. But we continued on fellowshipping as we had been. And as time went on, we no longer had some governing body telling us, in essence, doing our doctrine for us, doing our theology for us. We had to figure everything out ourselves. As time went on, and we slowly, very slowly, began to change one thing and another thing until we have so much in common that we can fellowship very easily today. I don't have any struggle with any of you at all, doctrinally. Having said that, my Christology, the Christology into which I was born, was very low, much lower than probably anyone else in here, unless there's an atheist in the room. I grew up with the belief that Jesus Christ was sitting on the right hand of God, in a chair, and that was our Christology. Period. He was sitting there. That's all he did was sit. He couldn't hear us. He didn't know what was going on. Maybe he was working on the New Jerusalem with his hammer and screwdrivers as the carpenter. He goes to prepare a place for us, right? No, I'm just kidding. But So our Christology was very low. We were so reactionary in our theology. We were so against the Trinity that became what defined us. Anything that sounded like the Trinity, we would immediately recoil from. So that's where I came from. I have raised the bar a lot in my own personal understanding of Jesus and his heavenly ministry. And we're all just trying to find a balance, is what we're doing here. We're trying to find out what is the biblical understanding, what would Jesus do, what would Jesus say, how would Paul answer the question, if you went up to Paul the Apostle and said, should we worship Jesus, what would he say? If you asked Jesus, who do you worship, what would Jesus say? Those are the questions I'm trying to ask. I have a very high opinion of Jesus today. I think he's the highest exalted person in the universe next to God. I believe that. However, I think he's still a man. So, however we figure that out is our quest. I wanted to just develop an outline and do it that way, but this subject is so delicate that I think that if I said one word the wrong way, I would offend you. So I'd like to go along with the paper as much as possible, and it's not my intention to offend anyone. That's not what I'm in the business of. But let's just, as a community of believers in the one God, let's just consider these options. Starting in the second paragraph here, and I want to just lay out for you the conundrum. What is the what is the issue at hand here? Before I can delve into the conundrum facing Unitarians today, the stage must be set with the paradox that provokes such a question. Jesus is a strict monotheist. He quoted the Shema. He didn't apologize or reinterpret it. He quoted it as it is and without apology. He would not even allow himself to be called good, as someone already mentioned today. He said to Satan, "You shall worship the Lord your God and serve him only." Jesus said that. But then there's a tension present in the scriptures, because if you read the Gospels, it's like every other page, somebody comes up to Jesus and worships him. And then also in Revelation, as we progress through, we have these statements. Worthy is the Lamb. We have 24 elders, the living creatures, all these thousands of angels fall down before Jesus and before God, saying, "Worthy is the Lamb that was slain to receive power and riches and wisdom and might and honor and glory and blessing. To him who sits on the throne and to the Lamb be blessing and honor and glory and dominion forever and ever." Certainly sounds like worship to me. Certainly there is a tension present that yearns for resolution. However we resolve this, we need to do it so that everything is harmonized and not contradicting. So you see what the problem is? Jesus says there's only one God. Jesus says you only worship that one God, and yet he's worshipped all the time. That's the problem. So either he meant something else, or we should reinterpret what he said, or he wasn't really worshipped in the sense that we think he was. Here are some questions that I think as a community... Oh, by the way, we're the only ones doing this. Nobody else really needs to ask this question. If Jesus is God to you, you don't need to have a 7-page paper talking about whether or not he should be worshipped. If he's God, he should be worshipped. Simple as that. So we're doing this on our own. We have to figure these sorts of things out in a narrower community. That's not to say other people don't ask questions about it, but it's not a branch of study at the university. What is worship? Is it true that modern worship is limited to singing songs to God or Jesus? You come across that a little bit in your time? Who in the Bible was worshipped? Can one who is not God be worshipped? Isn't that idolatry? Can I worship the Father with everything and then have something left over for someone else? Isn't it the beauty of the belief of one God, who is the Father, that it's single-hearted, that I can single-heartedly devote myself to the Father? Isn't that the beauty of monotheism? What happens when I divide? After all, Jesus said, no one can serve two masters. How can I honestly fixate upon the one God with all my heart, mind, and soul, and strength if I'm also obliged to worship another? What would Jesus do? Here's a good question for us to ask. Who would he worship? How would he worship? What would he say if someone wanted to worship him today? These questions and many others need to be answered by our community, the Sassenian or Biblical Unitarian community. Other people aren't asking it, and so it turns to the modern monotheist to inspect this issue. I have a cheap dictionary I was given when I went to my first college, and it's one of these little paperback deals, real small, concise, called the American Century Dictionary. I looked up worship in there because I knew it was just a modern, regular, sort of average Joe definition you would get anywhere. And I have it in the box up there. Homage or service to a deity is the number one usage of the word worship today in modern America. And I've confirmed this with other dictionaries. Merriam-Webster online has a dictionary that says the same thing. Included within the definition of the word worship is that it is done to a deity. This is the modern language that we speak. If I say that I worship somebody, they're going to assume that I think that that somebody is a god. That's just part of the package today. That's how the word has changed over time. This is most likely a result of two factors. Number one, there's been a severe mutation of the word God. It is transmuted from a title to a name. And you guys are most of all aware of that issue. And number two, the fact that the three largest religions that influence us are all monotheistic or claim to be monotheistic. That is to say, they only worship God. So to understand this, the biblical definition of the word God is one that is in the role of God to others, or one who is mighty. In fact, humans were called gods on several occasions. Furthermore, the word God, Elohim, is even used as an adjective in certain places. And I have the references there for you. Additionally, the New Testament uses the word God in similar ways, but not nearly as much. However, the flexibility of this word has all but disappeared today. If I said that Abraham was God to Pharaoh, you might raise your eyebrow and say, what are you talking about? Unless you're familiar with the flexibility of the term Elohim in the Old Testament. In modern times, God is the name of the being who created everything, rather than the title of Yahweh, the person of God. This mutation of definition, if unnoticed, it places a colored lens over critical texts like John 1:18 or Hebrews 1:8, where you see the word God there applied to Jesus, and you have to, because God is the name of the Creator, you have to assume that, which is the thing we're against and the thing that we're trying to sort out in these conferences. And number two, since the three massively popular religions in America are monotheistic, they worship in a monotheistic way. That is to say, the worship is done to God only. Thus, if we worship Jesus, then he must be God, however that works out, whether it's Trinitarian or Binitarian. One can simply not worship one who is not God without being called a heretic or idolater. Even so, the biblical understanding of worship is much more flexible than that. Flexible worship. So my paper is set up to go through the Old Testament word for worship, which is shachah, and then the New Testament word for worship, which is proskuneo. And so that's what we're going to do, but I'm not going to read everything. I'll be skipping a little bit because I'm hungry. Just kidding. But lunch is next, so that's exciting. His most basic thing is I've been thinking about this for a long time now, thinking about worship, and you kind of pick up clues as you read through the Bible when someone's worshipped other than God and it's not idolatry. Like Abigail gets off her I don't remember if it was a donkey or a horse, it was probably a donkey, and worships David, and you're like, You know, and you start to get clues like that. And so I was tipped off that worship is perhaps more broad than our modern-day definition. And then Anthony, while we're sitting back there, hands me over this book, a book about translation bias written by someone I've never heard of. He flips to the chapter that is called Bowing to Bias, a whole chapter on proskuneo. And he says it's the same exact thing there. So I'm very encouraged at this moment. I'm very excited. Because I'm not inventing anything. It's not that I just came up with this. This guy says it even better than I do. So buy his book and read his chapter on that. I encourage you. But I'll just give it to you the way that I came to it. The word shacha is a word that means prostrate, depressed, especially reflexive in homage or royalty or to royalty or to God. To royalty or to God. Bow self down, crouch, fall flat, humbly beseech, do obeisance, do reverence, make to stoop, worship. And I have a listing there of all the different places in the NASB in the Old Testament where this word is used. And you notice how it's translated. It's translated bow yourself down, do homage, prostrate. And it's also translated worship quite a lot as well. But the ones that aren't worship outweigh the ones that are worship. The broad usage of the word, page 3. There are two ways in which the word worship is used in the Tanakh, another term for the Old Testament. General worship and religious worship. Adoration proper, and this is a quote from the Hastings Bible Dictionary, a great source for information, unbiased information, because they don't believe a word of it anyhow. They're mainly atheists. Don't read the article on God. It's something about the evolution of an idea or something, but they do very good work on the technical data. And he says that adoration proper was expressed by prostration to the ground or even by lying prone with the face touching the ground. And he gives references for that. As elsewhere, this posture was not at first confined to intercourse with God. As an act of special courtesy, it was adopted towards kings, towards strangers of mystical quality, an expression of close and respectful attachment, or with the design to conciliate or to honor. So he's saying that this is kind of a flexible thing. It wasn't just done to God. General worship could be done to anyone, while religious worship is only allotted to deity. However, there's a problem. The same word is used for both. So only the context can tell you which it is. Whether it is worship to God, that specific worship that you don't give to anyone else, or whether it's the more broad, like the Asian custom of bowing in a form of respect, or the Muslim prayer. Have you seen a Muslim pray before?
Yeah.
They go down, then they go down to their knees, touch their head to the ground, and then back up in reverse fashion. I had a friend that did that 5 times a day, of course, and he always had a little red mark here because he did it in the gym, and they had wrestling mats, and that's where he did it, and he got some sort of a reaction there. So I always knew when he got back from prayer. But that's a good mind picture for us to understand worship in the biblical atmosphere, is that going down, bowing down, and coming back up in front of someone. And you could do that to anyone that you felt deserved that honor, that respect. It's a humiliation. That's what it is. You humiliate yourself. You bring yourself low in front of someone else, which lifts the other one up in your eyes. This could so Abraham spoke to the sons of Heth, right, and about burying Sarah, and it says that he bowed to the people of the land. Well, that's the same word as worship. We don't need to belabor the point. And I have some other examples there for you as well. The narrow use of Shachah. The Torah is unwavering in its sole subscription to strict monotheistic worship. The most cherished creed, of course, of the Jewish people, as we heard it sung yesterday, is Hear, O Israel, Yahweh is our God, Yahweh is one. And it's repeated throughout Deuteronomy in different forms. The inevitable consequence of strict monotheistic belief is strict monotheistic worship, wouldn't you say? If you have a strict faith in monotheism, would you not have a strict practice or worship in monotheism as well? It would be strange to have a faith that was monotheistic and a worship that was polytheistic. The inevitable consequence, I believe, is that although the word worship is flexible, the particular kind of worship done for God or to God is not flexible. It's more of a narrow, an exclusive worship. Consider the text below. You shall fear, this is Deuteronomy 6:13, you shall fear only Yahweh your God, and you shall worship him and swear by his name. Now, Israel, what does Yahweh your God require from you but to fear Yahweh your God, to walk in his ways and love him, to serve Yahweh your God with all your heart and with all your soul? You shall fear Yahweh your God, you shall serve him and cling to him, and you shall swear by his name. And there's a couple others there. Yahweh is the one to whom the people must cling. You can't let a finger off. You have to cling onto him. Anything less is unacceptable. And furthermore, he's a jealous God. He does not want to share what is rightfully his with others. Just like if you're married, you're jealous with a godly jealousy for your spouse. That's your person. That's your spouse. If somebody else is coming in there and flirting or whatever, then that's a godly jealousy, that you're protecting what's yours. Now, for me to go after something that's not mine, somebody else's spouse or somebody else's whatever it is, then that's jealousy, that's envy, that's bad, right? Well, God deserves all worship, and so he's jealous for what is rightfully his. And it's in this context that I go to these scriptures. It's another dictionary, Wycliffe Dictionary of the Theology. It's a very very good dictionary as well. It's an evangelical dictionary. They do believe in it, and so they have a different perspective. Great article on the kingdom, by the way, in that one. And they say that no injury to God compares with the denial of his uniqueness and the transfer to another, the recognition due to him. In this light must be understood his references to himself as a jealous God. Exodus 20, verse 5, you shall not worship them or serve them, for Yahweh, whose name is jealous. Or, wait, I think I just combined two together. Yeah, I did. Exodus 20, verse 5, you shall not worship them or serve them, for I, Yahweh, your God, am a jealous God. Exodus 34, 14, you shall not worship any other God, for Yahweh, whose name is jealous, is a jealous God. Deuteronomy 4, 23 to 24, so watch for yourselves, that you do not forget the covenant of Yahweh, your God, which he made with you, and make for yourselves a graven image in the form of anything against which Yahweh your God has commanded you. For Yahweh your God is a consuming fire, a jealous God. Quoted again in Hebrews as well. He didn't stop being a consuming fire, a jealous God. You shall not worship them or serve them, for I, Yahweh your God, am a jealous God. Deuteronomy 6, 14 through 15. You shall not follow other gods, any of the gods of the people who surround you. For Yahweh your God in the midst of you is a jealous God. Otherwise, the anger of Yahweh your God will be kindled against you, and he will wipe you off the face of the earth. Wow. That's not open to discussion, this issue, as far as it's presented in Deuteronomy here. This is no small matter to God. He says that he will wipe them off the face of the earth if they follow other gods. This is not a suggestion. This is a commandment with distinct consequences for disobedience. Out of the 27 texts in Deuteronomy involving this topic of worship or service, 21 of them are don't do it to anyone else. That's what 21 of them say, and I have the references there. The evidence is overwhelming from the Torah, and you know this as well. Yahweh is God. He is to be worshipped wholeheartedly. The rest of the Old Testament confirms this simple monotheistic service to Yahweh. Even so, many hypothesize that once the page labeled New Testament is turned, that everything changes. So it's to this that we now turn. The chief word for worship in the New Testament is proskuneo, and it is very similar to that Old Testament word, shacha. In fact, the definition I propose to you is just as broad. That is to say, it can be done to humans. It can be done out of respect and not only to God. In the King James, the word proskuneo is translated worship 60 times out of 60 times. It's very consistent. They always translate it worship. However, in our more modern translations, they will tend to use other words as well to accommodate the meaning that I told you about in the beginning. That is, that worship is only done to a deity. The New Testament, although written in Greek, is a Jewish document, almost exclusively written by Jews. Here, as in the Old Testament, are found references to general worship. And I give you two examples here. Let's look at that little chart. Herod supposedly wants to worship Jesus. Remember when the Magi came to Herod and said, well, we saw a star, we're going to go worship him. And Herod says, oh, you found the king of the Jews. Let me go worship him too. You know, of course, he's being deceitful. He really wanted to kill him, right? But did Herod think that this newborn child was God? No. All he knew was that he was the king, that he was the long-awaited Messiah. And in fact, this guy says the same exact thing. He says it's the furthest thought from Herod's mind. He just knows that somebody was born king of the Jews. He's the king of the Jews. Little problem here. Let's wipe him out. The Roman soldiers, when they mocked Jesus, and they bowed to him and worshipped him. Of course, they were doing it to mock him, but they were doing it in the context of, he's the king of the Jews. Let's do what would be done to a king, to him, in mockery. They weren't like, he's God. It didn't say over his head, here is Jesus, he claimed to be God. It says, here is Jesus, the king of the Jews. The Gentile woman worships Jesus begging for healing. The Gentile woman would not, it just wouldn't make sense. She didn't even know Jesus. You know, why would she just all of a sudden proclaim him God and fall in prostration? In the parable, the forgiven servant worships his master. And this is entirely hypothetical. It's a parable. And so this one also is more of the general usage of the word. And these are just the clear ones. Revelation 3:9, there's no question about this at all. It says that those who are of the synagogue of Satan will be forced to worship at the feet of the Philadelphian saints. Are the Philadelphian saints all gods? No. But if you have this mindset of worship being a broader thing, of bowing down, of doing obeisance to someone else, then you have no problem with that at all. And he says the same thing in this book as well. The narrow term of proskuneo is also used in the New Testament. The Bible does not cease to be a Unitarian document once the page labeled the New Testament is turned. In fact, the believers in the New Testament confirm and support the Shema, as we've already said. A text that clarifies who we are to worship is was already mentioned, 1 Corinthians 8:6. Yet for us there is but one God, the Father, from whom are all things, and we exist for Him. We exist for Him. It sounds very similar to Isaiah 43, verse 7, where he says, these are my people. I'm going to gather them together, my people who are created, made, and formed for my glory. It's very simple. We exist for Him. We are created for His glory. That's what we're here for. That's our purpose. And it says, we have one Lord Jesus Christ, through whom are all things, and we exist through Him. The Father, God, created all things. He is the source from which everything, including Jesus, originated. He is the one God, and we are able to come and worship Him through Jesus Christ. The Father made everything, and we experience things through Christ. We are in Christ. How many times do you see in Christ in the New Testament? We're within the sphere of Christ, and within that sphere we can worship God. The Lord Jesus is eminently important. As I said before, He's the highest exalted person in the universe next to God. There's no question about that. But yet even He confessed that the Father was His God, just as the Father is our God, John 20:17. Jesus once discussed this subject, the subject of worship, with the Samaritan lady. Remember, he was leaning against the well because he was tired? Something that, you know, after a long day's journey, you can understand, right? The Samaritans had believed that worship should be done on this mountain, Mount Gerizim. And the Jews, of course, believed it should be done in Jerusalem. And there was a question that she had in regards to this subject. And Jesus responded to her saying, "Woman, believe me, an hour is coming when neither in this mountain nor in Jerusalem will you worship the Father. You worship what you do not know. We worship what we know, for salvation is from the Jews. But an hour is coming, and now is, when the true worshipers will worship" who? "The Father in spirit and in truth. For such people the Father seeks to be His worshipers. God is spirit, and those who worship Him must worship in spirit and truth." Three times Jesus states that worship is done to the Father here. Then in the last sentence, He equated the Father to God. In Jesus' mind, they were the same. And again, this is all across the Old Testament as well. Jesus didn't change worship. He just brought it to the next level. Worship was done in the temple. It was done with sacrifices. That was the main means of worship. The religious worship. You wouldn't sacrifice to King David. You wouldn't sacrifice to another human being. That was only for God. And so Jesus brings it to a new level. He is the sacrifice. So He takes away all that, the issues that arose around the sacrifices in the Old Testament, where we had hypocrisy and we had all these, and it just didn't really work that well, the whole sacrificial thing as far as worship is concerned. And so Jesus brings us to a whole nother level. He says you don't even have to go to the temple anymore. Location doesn't matter. Truth does. God is one who is worshipped in spirit and in truth. And so Jesus brings worship to the next level, not of Himself, but of God. One of Satan's goals is to divert the worship of Yahweh to himself. He endeavored to do this when he tempted Jesus in the beginning of His ministry. This is one of Satan's main goals, it appears. The third temptation, according to Matthew 4, was to give Jesus all the kingdoms of the world and their glory if you will fall down and worship me, the devil. Satan was offering Jesus a shortcut to the kingdom. He was fulfilling Jesus' destiny without the need to die on the cross, a very tempting offer. But Jesus put His foot down. He quoted the Old Testament, "You shall worship Yahweh your God and serve Him only." The worship issue was clear for Jesus. He was not about to hedge even for a moment. He would worship only the Father as God, and we must do the same. But what about all those times when people came up to Jesus and worshiped Him in the New Testament? And I would submit to you that they are under the broad umbrella rather than the narrow of the term worship. I have a Hastings quote that backs that up, and then also this book says the same. A second category of proskuneo done to Jesus is in when people proskuneo Jesus, there's three categories. One is they need a miracle. The other one is he's recognized as king, either in mockery or in sincerity. And the third is he's the Son of God. All right? So the part where he can do a miracle and you want him to do a miracle, you come up to him and you give him all the respect you can possibly muster up because your daughter's dying. And if you show him enough respect and beg him enough, he might come and heal her. That's for a lot of the cases. The case of being the king, it was regular practice of the day that you would bow before the king in respect of his kingship. And then the third, as the Son of God, all depends on how you define the words Son of God. If Son of God is God the Son, then yes, this is an act of divine worship in the narrower sense. But if Son of God, as Hebrews 1:5 seems to indicate, means the one that was destined to be the appointed Messiah brought onto the human scene about 2,000 years ago, and that Son of God is really a synonym for Messiah, 2 Samuel 7:14 to 16, then we don't have any worship of Jesus as God. But what if the translators think Jesus is God? Then we might have a little bit of a problem, right? Then they will translate proskuneo, worship, rather than bow down, effectively steering the modern reader to confession that Jesus is God. And the reasoning is circular. And to illustrate this, I got this little marker here. It says, Jesus is God. Jesus is God. Therefore, let's translate proskuneo, worship. Okay? This is in the mind of the translators. And then they said, well, if Jesus is worshipped, then he must be God. So we started and ended at the same point. We proved ourselves right what we is assumed. We proved our assumption right by our assumption. It proves nothing, of course. This is what circular reasoning is. However, in order to understand this a little bit better, I'm doing pretty good on time. I had a 90-minute segment last time. This is ridiculous, isn't it? 90 minutes. I was like, how are you going to fill 90 minutes? In about 84 minutes, Ken says, we're going to have questions or what, buddy? So I'm really watching it this time. But this circular reasoning needs to be exposed to the light so that people can make the decision on their own. This is exactly the point that this man makes in this book here. He says that, well, whatever the interpretation is, let's just be honest with the translation. There's no way that this is properly translated worship in all these cases. Let me read to you from it. It says, the prostration made to Jesus fit within the cultural attitudes discussed at the beginning of this chapter, the cultural attitudes I told you about earlier. They are gestures of respect made to a superior in either spiritual, social, or political sense. In every case, we are dealing with a physical gesture that was used more broadly than just the context of worship. You can see, however, the 9 translations that are being compared here, they all translate it differently. Since Greek words such as proskuneo have a range of possible meanings, it is not practical to insist that the Greek word always be translated the same way, as in the King James. Every one of the 60 times, it's always worship. Since it is more, and in 1611, that was still more of a understood as something done out of respect. I mean, even today, you go to England, you can call a superior political figure my worship. It's a title. But in our American society, this word has changed. There are more valid and less valid contexts to consider making a choice. But in exploration of this issue, we can see how theological bias has been the determining context. Theological bias has been the context of translating these words. There are passages where many translators have interpreted the gesture referred to the passages by the Greek proskuneo as implying worship. So they've interpreted, not translated it, interpreted it. And then they have substituted the interpretation in the place of translation. So this is, you know, a subtle thing that just an average person reading the New Testament, seeing Jesus be worshipped all over the place, they know worship is only done to God. That's what the word worship means to us today. And so it's very easy for them to be coerced into a belief rather than allowing them to come to a belief on their own. I'm not going to enter a debate over interpretation. It's always possible that the interpretation of the significance of the gesture may be correct, but the simple translation, prostration or do homage or do obeisance, is certainly correct. So let's just translate it that way, is his point here. The question needs to be raised, why depart from a certain accurate translation to a questionable, possible, inaccurate one? The answer is that when this occurs, the translators seem to feel that the need to add to the New Testament support for the idea that Jesus was God be recognized. They want to add that to the translation so that it's easier for you to see what the Bible already says. See, they're starting with that assumption that Jesus is God, therefore let's translate it worship, and they want you to start with Jesus is worship, therefore he's God. But the presence of such an idea cannot be supported by selectively translating a word one way when it refers to Jesus and another way when it refers to someone else. And that's what I propose to you is going on here. Since such acts of worship are made to others besides Jesus in the New Testament, and Jesus even tells a story in which the gesture is made to an ordinary person, we can rule out the idea that prostration means worship in the modern sense of the English word. I thought that was phenomenal. This is Jason David Badoon, Truth in Translation. And he deals with other issues as well. An enlightening section of Scripture which may clarify some of this mess for us is found in Psalm 2, one of the most messianic psalms in the entire Bible. It says in verses 11 and 12, "Worship Yahweh with reverence and rejoice with trembling. Do homage to the Son, that he not become angry and you perish in the way, for his wrath may soon be kindled. How blessed are all who take refuge in him." You see how simple, how beautiful that is? You worship Yahweh as that narrow religious worship, that special thing that only as Elohim he can have. And then you give homage to Jesus. You give homage to the Son because he is the appointed Messiah. We are to worship Yahweh and do homage to the Son. The Father is the object of our religious worship. The Son is bowed to in reverence of his position and what he has done. In fact, the words "do homage" are literally "kiss." If you have King James, it'll say "kiss." It says "kiss the Son," which is a striking parallel to the word proskuneo, because kuneo also means kiss. It's a very similar setting there. Like loyal subjects falling on their knees before their king and kissing his hand, we are to come before God's appointed king, Jesus Christ. And that is worship that is done to Jesus. That's the proper biblical way that Jesus is to be worshipped. This is exactly what the people did in the references in the New Testament. They fell down before their king or before the one who was able to perform healings, or as an act of desperation or gratitude or respect or honor. They were not worshiping in our modern usage of the word, but rather they were paying homage. Likewise, I think if any of us saw Jesus, if he pulled a John 20 and just showed up in the middle of the room, I think all of us would have the same response. We would fall to the ground in respect to our King, the Son of God. Every knee will bow to Jesus, according to Philippians 2. Every knee will bow. But he is not the object of religious worship. In fact, the next verse says that the knees bowing are all for the glory of God the Father. It is as if, and I got this from Gary last year, it is as if Jesus is in heaven with his finger pointing at the Father. And everyone here is staring at the finger thinking, wow, look at that finger. Rather than taking the cue, hello, he's up there as the conduit, as the through man, right? Everything is through Jesus, 1 Corinthians 8:6. Let's follow the finger and see where it leads. Let's do what he did. Let's look at the Father as our object of religious worship. Let's not fixate on the finger, but rather take his cue and look to the one God and Father who is above all and in all and through all and in all as our object of religious worship. I have intended here to just begin a discussion on this subject. I'm not dogmatic. I talked to my wife last night. She's like, well, you know, you'll do good because you're really convinced of this. You have a lot of passion about it. I'm not totally convinced. This is an inquisition. Well, that's a bad word. This is the beginning of a that's too close, of an inspection or a we're just looking at this investigation. There it is. Thank you. Count on Richard Fix. An investigation into this subject. And I suggest that for all of us, we can, when we see the word worship look at the context. Get into the mind of the people who are doing it. When Jairus comes up and worships Jesus, as the NASB puts it, is he confessing Jesus as God, someone he's never met before in his whole entire life? He's never even heard a sermon. He just hears that he does miracles. The Hastings Bible Dictionary is in agreement with us on this issue. They say there's no way that that was a confession of his divinity. I have intended to begin a discussion. I do not claim to have exhausted the issue. Our community needs to open an investigation. There it is, right there. Investigation into this practical doctrine, because it comes down to our services, whether it's midweek or end of the week, whatever. In our services, how are we treating Jesus and how are we treating God? I was attending a church where they sang 4 out of 5 songs to Jesus as the one to be worshipped, and then maybe one would be to the Lord. So that goes either way in modern music, right? And so I'm thinking to myself, well, if Jesus were here, he would be singing to God. Why are all these people singing to Jesus? You know, it got me thinking. And then sometimes you hear a song that says, I will give him all my worship, and you give that to the Father, and then 2 songs later say, well, and let's worship Jesus. And it's just terribly confusing, isn't it, the way things are today? Christomonism is running rampant in the modern music of our day, the worship music of our day. Christomonism is the belief that there's only Christ, no Father, no Holy Spirit. It's a serious issue that evangelicals are upset at the music industry about. And it's something that we need to also discuss. We need to investigate this subject. Anybody have any questions? I have a new mic man back there. Yeah. John?
Sean. Well, first of all, great job.
Thank you.
And a couple comments. One, to sort of back up what you were saying about the word worship in English. I think I've read that in an Anglican wedding ceremony, there's a line, I think, that the groom says it's something like, with my body I thee worship. It sort of shows the connection there. Now, I should also point out, where did I read that quote? I think you're, in a sense, you're not as alone as you think you are in sort of looking at this. There certainly is a very big, very active scholarly literature in this field, recent scholarly literature.
Well, that's encouraging.
And certainly one name that comes to my mind that I think you'll need to look at to kind of, you know, as you round out your picture and continue your investigation is Larry Hurtado.
Who?
Larry Hurtado.
Okay.
Hurtado. And I think that the source to go to probably is his recent book, Lord Jesus Christ. I haven't read it myself. It's a big book about the length of the one that that Ken was talking about. But he's thought really hard about what exactly is worship, and with lots of other scholars arguing different ways about that. So those will be good sources to look at as you continue your investigation, I think.
I appreciate that. Dixon. He's coming. This is Jason David Badun, Dunhn. It's in the bibliography of the program. Good, good. So then you guys are already aware of this, and this is just my own personal.
That's my copy.
And then we have Ken's copy right here. Why do you guys keep these secrets? But it's called Truth in Translation. By the way, if you want to get any books off the off the internet, bookfinder.com. That's where I go. Bookfinder will search Amazon. It'll search ABE books. It'll search A1 books. It'll search every book selling website on the internet for you and give you the prices in order from the cheapest to the most expensive for used and for new. A column for each. That's bookfinder.com. I use it all the time. I never pay more than $4 for a book.
Wow.
That's an exaggeration. Maybe it's 5 or 6. I'm sorry. What was that?
I had a comment and does anybody notice that in the Q&A sessions, we're not actually asking questions. We're giving our own little commentaries. I just think it's an interesting observation anyway.
Well, that's the A part.
right. Okay, that's the A part.
Now I have to come up with a question. What are we doing in these sessions?
There we go. Giving commentaries. Your presentation brought up a little thing. This is Church of God specific or Worldwide Church of God specific.
Okay.
But I have a publication that uses the word mister a lot. I mean, I will say Mr. Westby, I will say Mr. in second references to people. And I get criticized for that a lot by fellow Church of God people. This may not be something that ever comes up. But a lot of Church of God people will not use the word Mr. because it means master. And if I say Mr. Westby, I'm implying to them that I'm worshiping Ken there. So I think what you have said is an interesting commentary to that. As a footnote, I'm not allowed on the Like Minds Forum. because they know my first post when I would deliberately say Mr. Maybe my friends on the Like Minds Forum know that.
Dixon was saying that he catches a lot of flack in his publications because he uses the term Mr., which is implied to be master, which is implied to be someone who is worshipped, that Dixon maybe worships Ken when he says Mr. Ken Westby. He just wanted to
defend myself.
He wanted to defend himself. He does not worship Ken Westby, for the record.
But he does like him. There's more to the story. There's two misters in English. There's two derivations. One is
the Yankees and one is Southern.
There we go. One is from Rob, which is great, which is where you get the great teacher, great master, and that sort of thing. Of course, that's where rabbi comes from. But the other one just means simple master, which would be not ecclesiastically relevant and therefore totally appropriate even for those who don't like mister, because they're not addressing a higher ecclesiastical position.
What are the two then?
They're both mister.
Oh.
It's the one is if you use Mr. in a context of to one superior in ecclesiastical structure, like let's say you were a bishop or
a
priest or something like that, that would be the Rab Mr. because that was the derivation because it came from an ecclesiastical background. Mm-hmm. But just to say, you know, Mr. Jones or Mr. Smith, how you doing today? No problem at all.
Well, just clarification.
In our background. Mr. is our, in certain contexts, is the equivalent of reverend. And yet we don't say reverend, therefore we don't say Mr. Therefore we carry it on and don't say Mr. to anybody. And we don't like people saying Mr. to anybody. I'm just a clarification. And these people here will know exactly what I'm talking about.
I would have been lost if you didn't say that. I appreciate that. I have all sorts of weird quirks from my background as well that I won't bore you with. But
could you repeat that?
He was saying that that Mr. is so close to reverend, or in certain contexts, so that he doesn't use Mr. People don't use Mr. at all because then it might be misunderstood as reverend or someone that is. But Dixon is breaking free from the mold, and he's using it as a simple title for a man. Simple sign of respect. As a protocol and a courtesy.
Sean, when you are practicing your courtesy in England, you address the mayor as his worship, not my worship.
Okay, thank you.
Just a small point. I don't want you kicked out of England unnecessarily, see? When you go
to our England listeners, yes. Anthony has just corrected that it's his worship, not my worship,
right,
in reference to the mayor.
His majesty, her majesty. You don't address the queen as my majesty.
How impersonal.
I want you to get that right. Anyway, second point, there is a Greek word, latrevo, which means strictly to do religious worship. It's not used of Jesus in the New Testament at all. 21 times, check that word latrevo. It might add a little extra point to the point you were making.
What Anthony just said is that the word latrevo in Greek is the word most often rendered serve, right? And that is only done to God. It's never done to Jesus 21 times in the New Testament. Furthermore, there's another reference that might give clarity to that Revelation text I opened with in the first couple of paragraphs there. In Chronicles, it says that people worshipped Yahweh and the king, King David. So that gives clarity to the end time, the ultimate David, where Yahweh and the son of David, the Messiah, Jesus, is sharing that worship. I think it's a great parallel.
Hi, Sean. Yeah. Thank you for that presentation. I come from an X-Way group as well.
Hey, man, we got to get together.
And it's called Christian Educational Services, if you've heard of it. Published One God, One Lord.
Everybody here knows CES because of the thick book, One God, One Lord,
well,
and
I'd...
also the Rakovian Catechism, which they have exclusive rights to.
We do?
Yes.
Anyways, I'm the finance guy for the ministry, and I didn't know we had the rights to it. I thought we just reprinted it. But
we're the only ones that have it.
Right. I don't think we have any rights to it. We do print it, though. But anyways, this article, we have one just like this, and we could have written this just as well, and I appreciate it. But one of the things that we do is we have a lot of modern music in our ministry, but like you said, we wouldn't have a service with five songs just to Jesus. but everyone would sing the songs with the same exact thought as this. And so I would, maybe you could comment on, is that music invaluable to the Christian church today because of so many Christians misusing God and worshiping Jesus?
By invaluable, really valuable or not valuable?
Like invaluable to personal worship, to connecting with the Lord as
precious.
Precious. Does it have any benefit to us?
Okay.
Is it worth just throwing away, or is it something we should look at, or is it how do you relate to modern music in the context of this knowledge of worship? Yeah.
God. The question is, you know, how should we feel about the modern music? Well, first, you made a point that CES Ministries is in line with this view that I've expressed in this paper. And what's your website there?
BiblicalUnitarian.com.
Okay. And so there's some articles there. And also he was saying that in our worship, which the when you say worship, he was referring to is the singing of the songs, which is not, you know, and I think we agree on this, is not the only thing that is counted as worship. Our lifestyle is worship according to Romans 12:1. We are a living sacrifice. And we also have personal worship in our devotional time with God, where we talk to Him in prayer and listen to Him in reading of the Bible. And then we also have corporate worship, which is where we get together in a service and lift Him up together and show Him the worth due His name. And so the question is the modern Jesus music, or I don't know how you would call it, does it have value for us? I don't know. I mean, honestly, music can be so powerful, can't it? When you really get into a song, and that happens to me sometimes. So I'm somewhat guarded when I listen on the radio. You know, you really start getting into a song, and they're singing, and they're talking about how they always use ambiguous terms like Lord or God or just He. And say, oh, He created the heavens and the earth. He's my Father. He's the greatest. And then all of a sudden, you know, I'll get really into it. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, they say, Jesus, you are the – and it turns out that all the previous worship that we had done up to that point was really to Jesus, at which point I feel betrayed and I change the station. I mean, I think there can be value to it. And I'll tell you what we do in our local church is we a lot of times we'll just change that one word. If there's – one word that just throws the whole song off and makes it biblically inaccurate, we just, you know, change that word. And you guys do that too. They do it down in Georgia a lot of times. But I think it's something that we need to be very aware of and concerned with.
Most of the time, Sean, we don't listen to the music. It's like we play a guitar or something. So it's like it's our song.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like we're not on the radio or the CD as much as it's like, how do we – as a group sing it, and we get guys with drums and guitars and stuff, and so it's like we're creating it,
right?
Really. And so we really do take license with that and change the words sometimes.
or you know, we can write our own songs too, you know. Yeah. I mean, that's another availability.
Thank you for addressing this issue, and as someone who has a very informal kind of a music ministry, I appreciate this. But what I want to just ask you is, do you believe that we should not be singing a song of praise to Jesus during our worship service?
I have considered this question a lot in my own mind and thought about it a lot. I sing songs to my wife in the morning sometimes, and she says, shut up and go to bed. Or, you know, maybe she'll, you know, sometimes you get a romantic song going or something. You know, guys, what I'm talking about. You know, so, I mean, I can sing songs to my wife without anyone being confused that she's my God. So I think it's entirely fine to sing songs to Jesus, especially if He can hear us, as the New Testament seems to indicate that He's the one that searches our minds and hearts, according to Revelation 2. So if Jesus can hear us through the Spirit, then why not sing songs to Him? But at the same time, if singing songs is your special thing that you reserve for God alone, then I wouldn't put Jesus in there. Because, like sacrifice in the Old Testament, that was His special thing. You wouldn't sacrifice to King David. You wouldn't sacrifice to anyone unless you thought, you were totally convinced, and you wanted to show it that that person was God.
But do we not praise Jesus during the service at all?
So all we can ever do is praise Jesus. To praise is to speak well of. So we can never not praise Jesus. He was perfect. He never did anything wrong. Every time we talk about him, we praise him. As far as should we have a special time for praising Jesus, I mean, I don't know. That's why I said I wanted to open a discussion on the subject. The last thing I want to do is bring Jesus down lower than he should be or put him higher than he would comfortable being. I mean, somebody came up to him and he said, you know, good master, and Jesus couldn't handle that. He said, no, don't call me good. You don't know. I mean, that's God alone. And he was perfect. So, and he's now glorified as well. So, like I said, I don't know, and this is not something I would die for this belief. This is something I'm investigating, and I think we can all look into that. But by Ken's stance there, it appears that lunch is upon us.